The implications of it. What were, in other words, what were those troubling words that were preached in India? First of all, and what is the NU text? In a few words, it stands for the Nestle Holland United Bible Society version. In a few words. Well, after 500 years of study of the Greek New Testament manuscripts, the NU is considered to be state of the art. After, I say 500 years because up until about the 1400s, the Bible was written in Latin, and people who could read the Bible read it in Latin. But in the 1400s,
interest in the Greek New Testament, the Greek sources, revived, especially by a Dutch theologian by the name of Erasmus. Erasmus assembled a Greek New Testament from several handwritten manuscripts that he collected, and he printed, had it printed on the newly invented printing press. This is in the late 1400s. His first edition was printed in 1516. So that's my 500 years of Greek study from the early 1500s until today. After his death, his Greek New Testament became the standard, and it was continually edited after the 1500s, became known as the Textus Receptus within about 100 years. That is the edition of 1633. The publisher of that text in 1633 said in his preface that the text is received by all. This is the text that is received by all. So it became, in Latin, the Textus Receptus, or the received text. And it was further improved and edited along the way after Erasmus, and was the translation, or it is the basis of the translation used by Tyndale and Luther in German, and the King James comes from that text, and so on, others as well. But somehow, and I haven't pinned down exactly where and when, somehow that Textus Receptus picked up some extra words in Acts 15:24. The words saying, "You must be circumcised and keep the law." The text, the Greek text that Erasmus used, were very good, but they were from around the 9th century. They were old, but they had been copied for many years by hand, many times. And it looks like by the time the copies were made by Erasmus, or the copies that Erasmus used, by the time those things were made, they had picked up comments or marginal notes and added them to the text of the Greek text. There are other examples. The most glaring example, if you've got a King James or a New King James, look at 1 John 5:7. I won't turn there, but 1 John 5:7-8 is a glaring example of an addition to the Greek text. It's supposed to say, "For there are three that bear witness in the earth, and that they are spirit, water, and blood." But somebody, probably a Trinitarian, who wanted to make it a little clearer, or thought he had a good analogy there, added, "For three that bear record in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Ghost, and these three are one. They added that. And there is no Greek manuscript earlier than the 16th century that ever said that. It seems to have been a carryover, perhaps, from Latin, from the Latin translations of the Bible. It was somebody's inspired notes. But from there, from those 9th century or so texts, those words got into the King James. You've probably already scratched them out in your Bible if you have a King James. In 1 John 5:7-8, some of those words. But anyway, so it was for Acts 15 and verse 26. The words saying you must be circumcised and keep the law are not in the really old manuscripts. Just coincidentally, last week I was reading a very old work from the 300s by Epiphanius' Panarium, from the 300s, and he happens to quote in there the full text of Acts 15:24. It's not in his quotation either, because it's not in the original. Because in Erasmus's day, he had access to maybe dozens of old Greek manuscripts. But then as interest in the Greek manuscripts grew over the centuries, the number of accessible manuscripts accessible to scholars has increased to the thousands, where today it's over 5,000. There are 5,000 Greek manuscripts, handwritten manuscripts, accessible to scholars, plus another 18,000 manuscripts written in other languages, especially Latin and Armenian. Well, okay, the study of these manuscripts grew from the 1400s up to 1898. In 1898, a man named Eberhard Nestle took the best editions of the Greek text, three in number at that time, and he combined them. He combined the best of those three. That is, wherever they differed, he took the majority. So this was the best New Testament Greek manuscript from the scholarly world at the end of the 1800s, 1898. And the N in NU is for him, Eberhard Nestle. It's been continually edited since then. The manuscripts are weighted not just based on how old they are, but where they come from, how carefully they were copied, and so on. In 1963, there was an edition which added clarifications or corrections from a lot more manuscripts, and that was edited by Kurt Aland in 1963. And so that work became the Nestle Aland version of the Greek. And then the United Bible Society, well, the United Bible Society uses that same text, virtually identical text, to translate the New Testament into other languages to distribute around the world. Anyway, the NU text is considered the state of the art in New Testament scholarship. And I'm not saying, therefore, that your King James or your New King James, which is based upon the old Textus Receptus, is inaccurate or that it's unreliable. It is not. The difference between the Textus Receptus and the NU are minor. I mean, they are trivial. Now, there are over 5,000 manuscripts. And looking at them all, there are over 100,000 variations between those 5,000 manuscripts. But mostly they are little things. They're little things like errors a copyist would make. If he read a whole sentence and then he copied it from memory, he might change the wording slightly. But he didn't change the meaning of it. He might change the order of the words or something like that. In the estimation of Westcott and Hort, they were two prominent editors of the Greek text in the 1800s. They say this, without orthographic, that is, without spelling differences, doubtful text variants exist in only 1/60th of the whole New Testament, most of them being comparatively trivial variations, with substantial variations forming hardly more than 1/1000th of the entire text. So the Textus Receptus is very much like the NU. But as I said, a few marginal notes have sneaked into some of the families of the later manuscripts, and the Textus Receptus picked up some of them. And one of them is Acts 15, verse 24, the little clarification where he says, what they were saying was, you must be circumcised and keep the law. It doesn't say that in the original. Now, why does that matter? Or does that matter? I think it matters because it's used by some to prove, or try to prove, that Acts 15 is about what laws we are supposed to keep as Christians and which ones we don't have to. I'll give you an example. I found this. It's rather a condescending paragraph here from gotquestions.org. Gotquestions.org is a Protestant evangelical site which tries to answer Bible questions, and they say this, quote, it is interesting that the issue of the Jerusalem Council was dealing, excuse me, that the issue which the Jerusalem Council was dealing with is still very much an issue in the church today. There are groups teaching that Christians must obey the Old Testament law. What groups would he be thinking of? Whether it is the Sabbath day or the food laws or all of the Old Testament law outside of the sacrificial system. There are groups that declare that observance of the law is either required for salvation or at least crucially important aspect of Christian life. Do you know anybody who thinks that obeying God's law is important? To continue. Sadly, he says, he's feeling sorry for us. Sadly, these groups either completely ignore or grossly misinterpret the decision of the Jerusalem Council. The specific goal of the Jerusalem Council was to decide what aspects, if any, of the Old Testament law Christians must observe. That was the purpose of the conference, he says. Was it really? Was the issue of the conference, what part of the law, if any of it, do you need to obey? Were those the troubling words that were brought to the Christians of Antioch? Let's back to the text here. Acts 15, verse 1 says, "And certain men which came down from Judea taught the brethren and said, except you be circumcised after the manner of Moses, you cannot be saved." Well, I see in that line only one troubling teaching, and it was circumcision. Now notice who taught it. It says these men, these certain men did not, you will notice in this chapter, go to Jerusalem to hear the answer. Now, the congregation wanted Paul and Silas and others to go up, Paul and Barnabas rather, to go up to Jerusalem and get an answer on this question. The men who brought the problem to them and said circumcision was necessary didn't go. You ever notice that? They didn't go. They didn't care what the apostles would say. They had probably been there already. They had already argued this with the apostles. And they had left Judea to find greener pastures, and they went to Antioch and preached it there. All that James says of them in verse 24 is really this: "We have heard that some went out from us without our authorization and disturbed you, troubling your minds by what they said." And verse 1 tells us what they said. Literally here, some of us, some who went out from us, is some of our company, some of our number, or church members. They were not emissaries of the apostles, these men, these certain men. They were supposedly church members, but they were teaching a doctrine opposite to what the apostles taught. And I think that, in fact, these certain men are the same men who are referred to by Paul as false brethren, unawares brought in, when he describes them in Galatians chapter 2. They had rejected the evidence. God had converted Cornelius years before and not required circumcision. God had made it clear in that case that circumcision was not necessary, but they are still disturbing the brethren in Antioch, saying you must be circumcised. Now it's true, the brethren wanted a clarification, so they sent Paul to Jerusalem, and it says in verse 5, "But there arose up certain of the sect of the Pharisees which believed, saying that it was needful to circumcise them and to command them to keep the law of Moses." This is a totally different group. These are not the men who preached circumcision in Antioch. Those men didn't go to Jerusalem. These, in verse 5, they are members of the church. They still favored circumcision, probably because it was quite plain, they thought, in the law. And they still deeply respected the law. But God had prophesied in the prophets that it would be circumcision of the heart. And it had truly been demonstrated already in the case of Cornelius. And in the end, these members who were former Pharisees did agree with the results of the conference. They all agreed in Jerusalem that physical circumcision was not necessary. Everybody agreed. And why? Because they went to the law. It was the law itself and the prophets that they appealed to for authority. It was from the law of God that they concluded what things new members of the church needed to obey, needed to observe. I've gone through that, the source of those four things in other times in verse 20, that are listed in verse 20. They are from the law, and they still need to be obeyed. as well, as James concludes in verse 21, along with everything else that is taught normally on the Sabbath, every Sabbath, from the Scriptures. The issue was not what laws, if any, Christians are to obey. That was not the issue in verse 1. It is not the issue in verse 24. The addition of those words in verse 24 supports that mistaken understanding. The certain men said nothing about the law in general. All they said was circumcision was necessary. And the certain men had their own reason for circumcision, I believe. And it was not to enter into a covenant agreement with God. Obedience to God's law was not their agenda. They had other reasons for advocating circumcision. And I have noted before, circumcision was a well-known Gnostic doctrine. These certain men had been in Jerusalem. They had already argued with the apostles in Jerusalem, and they had lost. And then they went to Antioch, where verse 2 says Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and disputation with them. And they never did reach consensus with the church. They went their own way. Well, my point is a small point at that. The King James Version, Acts 15, verse 24, has some text in it that shouldn't be there. Actually, whether that text should be there or not, it's really makes little difference, as the great bulk of the Scriptures makes pretty clear. But the extra text in verse 24 is one little bit of evidence, quote-unquote evidence, that is used to turn the point of the conference, Acts 15, upside down. And we should know that it is a very doubtful text. And knowing that bit of information confirms our understanding and grounds us in the defense of the faith once delivered.